kicking and punching until a police whistle freezes them and the gangs unite, pretending to be friends in front of Officer Krupke. For 9 minutes, no dialogue is spoken. Everything is communicated through dance. The first time West Side Story was performed in 1957, the audience wasn't certain what to make of it. The actors were dressed in everyday clothes, but moved as if in a classical ballet. The dances were as formalized as Swan Lake, but described street fights and attempted rape and skirmishes with cops. The music echoed the symphonic tritones of Wagner, but also the rhythms of Latin jazz. Throughout the musical, the actors switched between song and dialogue interchangeably. The ground rules by which West Side Story is played are laid out in the opening number, the theater historian Larry Stemple later wrote. Before an intelligible sentence has had a chance to be uttered, or a single phrase of music sung, dance has conveyed the essential dramatic information. When the curtain went down on opening night, there was silence. The audience had just seen a musical about rumbles and murder, songs describing bigotry and prejudice, and dances in which hoodlums moved like ballerinas, and actors sung slang words with the power of opera stars. As everyone prepared to take their positions for the curtain call, we ran to our spaces and faced the audience holding hands. The curtain went up, and we looked at the audience, and they looked at us, and we looked at them, and I thought, "Oh, dear Lord, it's a bomb," said Carol Lawrence, who played the original Maria. And then, as if Jerry had choreographed it, they jumped to their feet. I'd never heard people stamping and yelling. And by that time, Lenny had worked his way backstage, and he came at the final curtain and walked to me, put his arms around me, and we wept. West Side Story went on to become one of the most popular and influential musicals in history. It succeeded by mixing originality and convention to create something new. It took old ideas and put them in novel settings so gracefully that many people never realized they were watching the familiar become unique. Robbins forced his colleagues to become brokers, to put their own experiences onto the stage. "That was a real achievement," Robbins later said. 3. The space assigned to the Frozen team for their daily meetings was large, airy, and comfortable. The walls were covered with sketches of castles and ice caves, friendly-looking reindeer, a snow monster named Marshmallow, and dozens of concepts for trolls. Each morning at 9 a.m., the director, Chris Buck, and his core team of writers and artists would assemble with their coffee cups and to-do lists. The songwriters Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez would video conference in from their home in Brooklyn. Then everyone would start panicking about how little time was left. Anxiety was particularly high the morning after the disastrous screening and meeting with the Story Trust. From the beginning, the Frozen team had known they couldn't simply retell an old fairy tale. They wanted to make a movie that said something new. It couldn't just be that, at the end, a prince gives someone a kiss, and that's the definition of true love, Buck told me. They wanted the film to say something bigger, about how girls don't need to be saved by Prince Charming, about how sisters can save themselves. The Frozen team wanted to turn the standard princess formula on its head. But that's why they were in such trouble now. It was a really big ambition, said Jennifer Lee, who joined the Frozen team as a writer after working on another Disney film, Wreck-It Ralph. And it was particularly hard, because every movie needs tension. But if the tension in Frozen is between the sisters, how do you make them both likable? We tried a jealousy plotline, but it felt petty. We tried a revenge story, but Bobby kept saying we needed an optimistic heroine instead of feuds. The Story Trust was right. The movie needed to connect emotionally. But we didn't know how to get there without falling into clichés. Everyone in the room was well aware they had only 18 months to finish the movie. Peter Delveco, the producer, asked them all to close their eyes. "We've tried a lot of different things," he said. "It's okay that we haven't found the answers yet. Every movie goes through this, and every wrong step gets us closer to what works. Now, instead of focusing on all the things that aren't working, I want you to think about what could be right. I want you to envision your biggest hopes. If we could do anything, what would you want to see on the screen?" The group sat quietly for a few minutes. Then people opened their eyes and started describing what had excited them about this project in the first place. Some had been drawn to Frozen because it offered a chance to upend the way girls are portrayed in films. Others said they were inspired by the idea of a movie where two sisters come together. "My sister and I fought a lot as kids," Lee told the room. "Her parents had divorced when Lee was young. She had eventually moved to Manhattan while her sister became a high school teacher in upstate New York. Then, when Lee was in her early 20s, her boyfriend drowned in a boating accident. Her sister had understood what she was going through at that moment, had been there at a time of need. There's this moment when you start to see your sibling as a person instead of a reflection of yourself," Lee told the room. "I think that's what's been bothering me the most about this script. If you have two sisters, and one of them is the villain, and one is a hero, it doesn't feel real. That doesn't happen in real life. Siblings don't grow apart because one is good and one is bad. They grow apart because they're both messes, and then they come together when they realize they need each other. That's what I want to show." Over the next month, the Frozen team focused on the relationship between Anna and Elsa, the movie's sisters. In particular, the filmmakers drew on their own experiences to figure out how the siblings related. "We can always find the right story when we start asking ourselves what feels true," Delveco told me. "The thing that holds us back is when we forget to use our lives, what's inside our heads, as raw material. That's why the Disney method is so powerful, because it pushes us to dig deeper and deeper until we put ourselves on the screen." Jerry Robbins pushed his collaborators in West Side Story to draw on their own experiences to become creative brokers. The Toyota production system unlocked employees' capacity to suggest innovations by giving them more control. The Disney system does something different. It forces people to use their own emotions to write dialogue for cartoon characters, to infuse real feelings into situations that, by definition, are unreal and fantastical. "This method is worth studying, because it suggests a way that anyone can become an idea broker, by drawing on their own lives as creative fodder. We all have a natural instinct to overlook our emotions as creative material. But a key part of learning how to broker insights from one setting to another, to separate the real from the cliched, is paying more attention to how things make us feel. Creativity is just connecting things," Apple co-founder Steve Jobs said in 1996. "When you ask creative people how they did something, they feel a little guilty, because they didn't really do it. They just saw something. It seemed obvious to them after a while. That's because they were able to connect experiences they've had and synthesize new things. And the reason they were able to do that was that they've had more experiences, or they have thought more about their experiences than other people. People become creative brokers, in other words, when they learn to pay attention to how things make them react and feel. Most people are too narrow in how they think about creativity," Ed Catmull, the president of Disney Animation, told me. "So we spend a huge amount of time pushing people to go deeper, to look further inside themselves, to find something that's real and can be magical when it's put into the mouth of a character on a screen. We all carry the creative process inside us. We just need to be pushed to use it sometimes." This lesson isn't limited to movies or Broadway. The post-it note, for instance, was invented by a chemical engineer who, frustrated by bookmarks falling out of his church hymnal, decided to use a new adhesive to make them stay put. Cellophane was developed by an exasperated chemist looking for a way to protect tablecloths from wine spills. Infant formula was created in part by an exhausted father who suspended vegetable nutrients and powder so he could feed his crying child in the middle of the night. Those inventors looked to their own lives as the raw materials for innovation. What's notable is that, in each case, they were often in an emotional state. We're more likely to recognize discoveries hidden in our own experiences when necessity pushes us, when panic or frustrations cause us to throw old ideas into new settings. Psychologists call this creative desperation. Not all creativity relies on panic, of course, but research by the cognitive psychologist Gary Klein indicates that roughly 20% of creative breakthroughs are preceded by an anxiety akin to the stress that accompanied Frozen's development or the pressures Robbins forced onto his West Side Story collaborators. Effective brokers aren't cool and collected. They're often worried and afraid. A few months after the Story Trust meeting, the songwriters Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez were walking through Prospect Park in Brooklyn, anxious about all the songs they needed to write, when Kristen asked, "What would it feel like if you were Elsa?" As they walked past swing sets and joggers, Kristen and Bobby began discussing what they would do if they were cursed and despised for something they couldn't control. "What if you tried to be good your entire life, and it didn't matter because people constantly judged you?" she asked. Kristen knew this feeling. She had felt other parents' looks when she let their daughters eat ice cream instead of healthy snacks. She'd felt glances when she and Bobby let their girls watch an iPad inside a restaurant because they wanted a moment of peace. Perhaps Kristen wasn't cursed with some deadly power, but she knew what it felt like to be judged. It didn't feel fair. It wasn't her fault that she wanted a career. It wasn't her fault that she wanted to be a good mom and be a good wife and a successful songwriter. And so, inevitably, that meant things like home-packed snacks and sparkling dinner conversation, not to mention thank you notes and exercise and replying to emails, sometimes fell by the wayside. She didn't want to apologize for not being perfect. She didn't think she needed to. And she didn't think Elsa should have to apologize for being flawed either. "Elsa has tried to do everything right all her life," Kristen said to Bobby. "Now she's being punished for being herself, and the only way out is for her to stop caring, to let it all go." As they walked, they began riffing, singing snippets of lyrics. "What if they wrote a song that started with a fairy tale opening," Bobby suggested, "like the stories they read to their girls at night?" "Then Elsa could talk about the pressures of being a good girl," said Kristen. She jumped up on a picnic bench. "She could change into a woman," she said. "That's what growing up is, letting go of the things you shouldn't have to care about." She began singing to an audience of trees and trash cans, trying out lyrics for Elsa to convey that she's done being the good girl, that she doesn't care what anyone thinks anymore. Bobby was recording her impromptu song on his iPhone. Kristen spread her arms. "Let it go, let it go. That perfect girl is gone." "I think you just figured out the chorus," said Bobby. Back in their apartment, they recorded a rough draft of the song in their makeshift studio. In the background were the clinks of plates from the Greek restaurant downstairs. The next day, they emailed it to Buck, Lee, and the rest of the Frozen team. It was part power ballad and part classical aria, but infused with Kristen's and Bobby's frustrations and the emancipation they felt when they let go of people's expectations. When the Frozen team gathered at the Disney headquarters the next morning, they put "Let It Go" on the sound system. Chris Montan, Disney's head of music, slammed his hand on the table. "That's it," he said. "That's our song. That's what this whole movie is about." "I have to go rewrite the beginning of the movie," said Lee. "I was so happy," Lee told me later. "So relieved. We had struggled for so long, and then we heard Let It Go, and finally, it felt like we had broken through. We could see the movie. We had been carrying the pieces in our heads, but we needed someone to show us ourselves in the characters, to make them familiar. Let It Go made Elsa feel like one of us." 4. 7 months later, the Frozen team had the first two-thirds of the film figured out. They knew how to make Anna and Elsa likable while driving them apart to create the tension the film needed. They knew how to portray the sisters as hopeful yet troubled. They had even transformed Olaf, the effing snowman, into a lovable sidekick. Everything was falling into place. Except they had no idea how to end the film. "It was this huge puzzle," said Andrew Milstein, president of Walt Disney Animation Studios. "We tried everything. We knew we wanted Anna to sacrifice herself to save Elsa. We knew we wanted the movie's true love to exist between the sisters. But we had to earn that ending. It had to feel real." When filmmakers get stuck at Disney, it's referred to as spinning. Spinning occurs because you're in a rut and can't see your project from different perspectives anymore, said Ed Catmull. "So much of the creative process relies on achieving distance, on not becoming overly attached to your creation." But the Frozen team had become so comfortable with their vision of the sisters, so relieved to have figured out the movie's basics, so grateful that the creative desperation had lifted a bit, that they had lost their ability to see other paths. This problem is familiar to anyone who has worked on a long-term creative project. As innovation brokers bring together different perspectives, a creative energy is often released that is heightened by a small amount of tension, such as the pressure that comes from deadlines or clashes that result when people from different backgrounds meld ideas, or the stresses of collaborators pushing us to do more. And these tensions can lead to greater creativity, because all those differences trigger divergent thinking, the ability to see something new when you are forced to look at an idea from someone else's point of view, said Francesca Gino, who studies the psychology of creativity at Harvard Business School. But when that tension disappears, when you solve the big problem and everyone starts seeing things the same way, people also sometimes start thinking alike and forgetting all the options they have. The Frozen team had solved almost all their problems. No one wanted to lose all the progress they had already made. But they couldn't figure out how to end the film. "You start spinning when your flexibility drops," said Catmull. "You get so devoted to what you've already created. But you have to be willing to kill your darlings to go forward. If you can't let go of what you've worked so hard to achieve, it ends up trapping you." So Disney's executives made a change. "We had to shake things up," said Catmull. "We had to jolt everyone. So we made Jen Lee a second director." In one sense, this change should not have made a huge difference. Lee was already the film's writer. Naming her as a second director, with equal authority to Chris Buck, didn't alter who was participating in the daily conversations. It didn't add any new voices to meetings. And Lee herself was the first to admit that she was as stuck as everyone else. But, Disney executives hoped, disrupting the team's dynamics just slightly might be enough to stop everyone from spinning in place. In the 1950s, a biologist named Joseph Connell began traveling between his home in California and the rainforests and coral reefs of Australia in an effort to understand why some parts of the world housed such incredible biological diversity while other regions were so ecologically bland. Connell had picked Australia for two reasons. First, he hated learning new languages. Second, Australia's forests and seascapes offered perfect examples of biological diversity and homogeneity in close proximity. There were long stretches of the Australian coast where hundreds of different kinds of corals, fish, and sea vegetation lived in very close quarters. Less than a quarter mile away, in another portion of the sea that seemed essentially the same, that diversity would plummet, and you might find only one or two kinds of coral and plants. Similarly, some pockets of Australia's rainforests contained dozens of different types of trees, lichen, mushrooms, and vines flourishing side by side. But just 100 yards away, that would dwindle to just one species of each. Connell wanted to understand why nature's diversity, its capacity for creative origination, was distributed so unevenly. His quest began in the Queensland rainforests, 12,600 square miles that contain everything from forest canopies to eucalyptus groves, as well as the Daintree Tropical Forest, where conifers and ferns grow right at the edge of the sea, and the Yungala National Park, where trees are so dense that, at ground level, it can be nearly lightless in the middle of the day. As Connell spent his days walking under green canopies and hacking through thick foliage, he found pockets of biodiversity that seemed to erupt out of nowhere. Then, just a few minutes away, that medley would dwindle until just one or two species remained. What explained this diversity and homogeneity? Eventually, Connell began noticing something similar at the center of each pocket of biodiversity. There was often evidence that a large tree had fallen. Sometimes he would find a decaying trunk or a deep indentation in the soil. In other verdant pockets, he found charred remains underneath the topsoil, suggesting that a fire, perhaps caused by lightning, had blazed for a brief but intense period before the rainforest's dampness had extinguished the flames. These fallen trees and fires, Connell came to believe, played a crucial role in allowing species to emerge. Why? Because at some point, there had been a gap in the forest where the trees had come down or had burned, and that gap was big enough to let sunlight in and allow other species to compete, Connell told me. Retired now, he lives in Santa Barbara, but he remembers the details from those trips. By the time I found some areas, years had passed since the fire or the tree fall, and so new trees had grown in their place and were blocking out the sun again, he said. But there had been a time when enough light had made it through that other species were able to claim some territory. There had been some disturbance that had given new plants a chance to compete. In those regions where trees hadn't fallen or fires hadn't occurred, one species had become dominant and had crowded out all competitors. Put differently, once a species solved the problem of survival, it pushed other alternatives away. But if something altered the ecosystem just a little bit, then biodiversity exploded. Only up to a point, though, Connell told me. If the gap in the forest was too big, it had the opposite effect. In those parts of the rainforest where loggers had cleared entire fields, where a huge storm had wiped out whole sections of the forest, or where a fire had spread too far, there was much less diversity, even decades later. If the trauma to the landscape was too great, only the hardiest trees or vines could survive. Next, Connell looked at reefs along the Australian coast. Here, too, he found a similar pattern. In some places, there was a dizzying assortment of coral and seaweed living in close proximity, while, just a few minutes by boat away, one species of fast-growing coral had dominated every square inch. The difference, Connell found, was the frequency and intensity of waves and storms. In those areas with high biodiversity, mid-sized waves and moderate storms came through occasionally. Alternately, in places with no waves or storms, just a handful of species dominated. Or, when waves were too powerful or storms came through too often, they would scrub the reef clean. It seemed as if nature's creative capacities depended on some kind of periodic disturbance, like a tree fall or an occasional storm, that temporarily upset the natural environment. But the disturbance couldn't be too small or too big. It had to be just the right size. Intermediate disturbances are critical, Connell told me. Within biology, this has become known as the intermediate disturbance hypothesis, which holds that local species diversity is maximized when ecological disturbance is neither too rare nor too frequent. There are other theories that explain diversification in different ways, but the intermediate disturbance hypothesis has become a staple of biology. The idea is that every habitat is colonized by a variety of species, but over time, one or a few tend to win out, said Steve Palumbi, the director of Stanford's Marine Station in Monterey, California. This is called competitive exclusion. If there are no disturbances to the environment, then the strongest species become so entrenched that nothing else can compete. Similarly, if there are massive, frequent disturbances, only the hardiest species grow back. But if there are intermediate disturbances, then numerous species bloom, and nature's creative capacities flourish. Human creativity, of course, is different from biological diversity. It's an imprecise analogy to compare a falling tree in the Australian rainforest to a change in management at Disney. Let's play with the comparison for a moment, though, because it offers a valuable lesson. When strong ideas take root, they can sometimes crowd out competitors so thoroughly that alternatives can't prosper. So sometimes the best way to spark creativity is by disturbing things just enough to let some light through. The thing I noticed when I first became a director was that the change was subtle, but at the same time very real, Jennifer Lee told me. When you're a writer, there's certain things you know a film needs, but you're just one voice. You don't want to seem defensive or presumptuous, because other people have just as many suggestions, and your job is to integrate everyone's ideas. A director, though, is in charge. So when I became a director, I felt like I had to listen even more closely to what everyone was saying, because that was my job now. And as I listened, I started picking up on things I hadn't noticed before. Some of the animators, for instance, were pushing to use the blizzard at the end of the film as a metaphor for the characters' internal turmoil. Others thought they should withhold any foreshadowing to make the ending a surprise. As a writer, Lee had viewed those suggestions as devices. But now she understood people were asking for clarity, for a direction in which every choice, from the weather on screen to choices about what is hidden or revealed, reflected a core idea. A few months after Lee's promotion, Kristen Anderson Lopez, the songwriter, sent Lee an email. They had been speaking almost every day for a year at this point. They talked at night and sent each other texts during the day. Their friendship didn't end when Lee became a director, but it changed a little bit. Kristen was riding a school bus, chaperoning her second-grade daughter on a class trip to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, when she pulled out her phone and typed a message to Lee. "Yesterday I went to therapy," she wrote. She and her therapist had discussed the Frozen team members' differing opinions about how the movie should end. They had talked about Lee's ascension to director. "I was discussing dynamics and politics and power and all that bullshit. And who do you listen to and how do you start?" she typed. Then she asked me, "Why do you do it?" And after parsing out the money and ego stuff, it all really comes down to the fact that I have things I need to share about the human experience, Anderson Lopez typed. "I want to take what I have learned or felt or experienced and help people by sharing it." What is it about this Frozen story that you, Bobby, and I have to say? Kristen asked. For me, it has something to do with not getting frozen in roles that are dictated by circumstances beyond our control. Lee herself was the perfect example of this. Lee had come to Disney as a new film school graduate with little besides a young daughter and a fresh divorce and student loans, and had quickly become a screenwriter at one of the biggest studios on Earth. Now she was the first female director in Disney's history. Kristen and Bobby were examples of people escaping their circumstances as well. They had fought for years to build the careers they wanted, even when everyone said it was ridiculous to hope they could support themselves by writing songs. Now, here they were, with hit Broadway shows and the life they had always hoped for. To earn Frozen's ending, Kristen said, they had to find a way to share that sense of possibility with the audience. What is it for you? Kristen typed. Lee replied 23 minutes later. It was 7 in the morning in Los Angeles. I love your therapist, she wrote, and you. All the different members of the Frozen team had their own ideas for the movie. Everyone on the Story Trust had become locked into their own concept of how the film should end. But none of them fit together perfectly, Lee felt. However, Frozen could have only one ending. Someone had to make a choice. And the right decision, Lee wrote, is that fear destroys us. Love heals us. Anna's journey should be about learning what love is. It's that simple. At the end of the film, when she sees her sister out on the fjords, she completes her arc by the ultimate act of true love. Sacrificing your needs for someone else's. Love is a greater force than fear. Go with love. Becoming a director forced Lee to see things differently, and that small jolt was enough to help her realize what the film needed, and to shift everyone else enough to agree with her. Later that month, Lee sat down with John Lasseter. "We need clarity," she told him. "The core of this movie isn't about good and evil, because that doesn't happen in real life. And this movie isn't about love versus hate. That's not why sisters grow apart. This is a movie about love and fear. Anna is all about love, and Elsa is all about fear. Anna has been abandoned, so she throws herself into the arms of Prince Charming because she doesn't know the difference between real love and infatuation. She has to learn that love is about sacrifice. And Elsa has to learn that you can't be afraid of who you are. You can't run away from your own powers. You have to embrace your strengths. That's what we need to do with the ending. Show that love is stronger than fear." "Say it again," Lasseter told her. Lee described her theory of love versus fear again, explaining how Olaf, the snowman, embodies innocent love, while Prince Hans demonstrates that love without sacrifice isn't really love at all. It's narcissism. "Say it again," Lasseter said. Lee said it again. "Now go tell the team," said Lasseter. In June 2013, a few months before the movie was set to open, the Frozen team flew to a theater in Arizona to conduct a test screening. What appeared on the screen was completely different from what had been shown in the Disney screening room 15 months earlier. Anna, the younger sister, was now bubbly, optimistic, and lonely. Elsa was loving, but scared of her own powers and tortured by the memory of accidentally injuring her sister when they were young. Elsa runs away to an ice castle, intending to live far from humanity, but she inadvertently plunges her kingdom into an endless winter and partially freezes Anna's heart. Anna begins searching for a prince in the hope that his true love's kiss will melt the ice in her chest. But the man she finds, Prince Hans, turns out to be intent on taking the throne for himself. Prince Hans imprisons Elsa and abandons the slowly freezing Anna, intent on killing both sisters so he can seize the crown. Elsa escapes from her cell and, near the end of the movie, is running across the frozen fjords, fleeing the corrupt prince. Anna is growing weaker as the ice inside her chest consumes her heart. A blizzard swirls around the sisters and Hans as they all find one another on the frozen sea. Anna is almost dead from the chill inside her body. Hans raises his sword, ready to slay Elsa and put the throne within his reach. As Hans's blade falls, however, Anna steps in front of the blow. Her body turns to ice just as the sword descends, and it strikes her frozen body rather than her sister. By sacrificing herself, Anna has saved Elsa, and this act of devotion, this genuine demonstration of true love, finally melts Anna's chest. She returns to life, and Elsa, released from the anxiety that she'll hurt the people she loves, can now direct her powers to defeat the evil Hans. She knows now how to end the kingdom's winter. The sisters, united, are powerful enough to overcome their enemies and their self-doubts. Hans is expelled, spring returns, and love defeats fear. All the elements of a traditional Disney plot were included. There were princesses and ball gowns, a handsome prince, a wisecracking sidekick, and a stream of upbeat songs. But throughout the film, those elements had been disturbed just enough to let something new and different emerge. Prince Hans wasn't charming. He was the villain. The princesses weren't helpless. Instead, they saved each other. True love didn't arrive in a rescue. Rather, it came from siblings learning to embrace their own strengths. "When did this movie get so good?" Kristen Anderson Lopez whispered to Peter Delveco as the screening ended. Frozen would go on to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature of 2014. Let It Go would win the Academy Award for Best Original Song. The film would become the top-grossing animated movie of all time. Creativity can't be reduced to a formula. At its core, it needs novelty, surprise, and other elements that cannot be planned in advance to seem fresh and new. There is no checklist that, if followed, delivers innovation on demand. But the creative process is different. We can create the conditions that help creativity to flourish. We know, for example, that innovation becomes more likely when old ideas are mixed in new ways. We know the odds of success go up when brokers, people with fresh, different perspectives who have seen ideas in a variety of settings, draw on the diversity within their heads. We know that sometimes a little disturbance can help jolt us out of the ruts that even the most creative thinkers fall into, as long as those shake-ups are the right size. If you want to become a broker and increase the productivity of your own creative process, there are three things that can help. First, be sensitive to your own experiences. Pay attention to how things make you think and feel. That's how we distinguish clichés from true insights. As Steve Jobs put it, the best designers are those who have thought more about their experiences than other people. Similarly, the Disney process asks filmmakers to look inward, to think about their own emotions and experiences until they find answers that make imaginary characters come alive. Jerry Robbins pushed his West Side Story collaborators to put their own aspirations and emotions on the stage. Look to your own life as creative fodder, and broker your own experiences into the wider world. Second, recognize that the panic and stress you feel as you try to create isn't a sign that everything is falling apart. Rather, it's the condition that helps make us flexible enough to seize something new. Creative desperation can be critical. Anxiety is what often pushes us to see old ideas in new ways. The path out of that turmoil is to look at what you know to re-inspect conventions you've seen work and try to apply them to fresh problems. The creative pain should be embraced. Finally, remember that the relief accompanying a creative breakthrough, while sweet, can also blind us to seeing alternatives. It is critical to maintain some distance from what we create. Without self-criticism, without tension, one idea can quickly crowd out competitors. But we can regain that critical distance by forcing ourselves to critique what we've already done, by making ourselves look at it from a completely different perspective, by changing the power dynamics in the room, or giving new authority to someone who didn't have it before. Disturbances are essential, and we retain clear eyes by embracing destruction and upheaval, as long as we're sensitive to making the disturbance the right size. There's an idea that runs through these three lessons. The creative process is, in fact, a process, something that can be broken down and explained. That's important, because it means that anyone can become more creative. We can all become innovation brokers. We all have experiences and tools, disturbances and tensions that can make us into brokers. If, that is, we're willing to embrace that desperation and upheaval, and try to see our old ideas in new ways. Creativity is just problem-solving, Ed Catmull told me. Once people see it as problem-solving, it stops seeming like magic, because it's not. Brokers are just people who pay more attention to what problems look like and how they've been solved before. People who are most creative are the ones who have learned that feeling scared is a good sign. We just have to learn how to trust ourselves enough to let the creativity out. Chapter 8. Absorbing Data. Turning Information into Knowledge in Cincinnati's Public Schools. Students were settling into their seats as the PA system crackled to life inside South Avondale Elementary School. "This is Principal Macon," a voice said. "I am declaring a hot pencil drill. Please prepare yourselves, prepare your worksheets, and we will begin in 5, 4, 3, 2. 2 minutes and 33 seconds later, 8-year-old Dante Williams slammed down his pencil, shot his hand into the air, and twitched impatiently as the teacher scribbled his finish time at the top of the multiplication quiz. Then Dante was out of his chair and flying through the door of his third-grade classroom, arms pumping as he speed-walked down the hallway, his worksheet creased in his fist. 3 years earlier, in 2007, when Dante entered kindergarten, South Avondale had been ranked as one of the worst schools in Cincinnati, which, given that the city had some of the lowest scores in the state, meant that the school was among the worst in Ohio. That year, South Avondale students had fared so poorly on their assessment exams that officials declared the school an academic emergency. Just weeks before Dante had stepped onto campus for the first time, a teenager had been murdered, one bullet to the head, one in the back, right next to South Avondale during a football tournament billed as a Peace Bowl. That crime, combined with the school's deep dysfunctions, poor academic scores, and a general sense that South Avondale had problems too big for anyone to solve, had caused city officials to ask if the Board of Education should close the campus altogether. The question, however, was where would they send Dante and his classmates? Nearby schools had scored only slightly better on assessment exams, and if those classrooms were forced to absorb additional kids, they would likely fall apart as well. The community around South Avondale had been poor for decades. There were race riots in the 1960s, and when the city's factories started closing in the 70s, the area's unemployment had skyrocketed. South Avondale administrators saw students coming to school malnourished and with marks of abuse. In the 1980s, the drug trade around the school exploded and never really let up. At times, the violence got so bad that police would patrol the campus's perimeter while classes were in session. "It could be a pretty scary place," said Yezveta Makin, who was principal from 2009 to 2013. Students didn't go to South Avondale unless there was no other place to go. One thing that wasn't a problem, however, was resources. The city of Cincinnati had poured millions of dollars into South Avondale. Local companies such as Procter & Gamble built computer labs and paid for tutoring and sports programs. In an effort to address the school's shortcomings, city officials spent nearly three times as many dollars on every South Avondale student as they did on students in more affluent communities, such as at the public Montessori campus across town. South Avondale had energetic teachers, devoted librarians and tutors, reading specialists, and guidance counselors who were trained in early childhood education and prepared to help parents sign up for state and federal assistance programs. The school also used sophisticated software to track students' performance. Administrators had embraced data collection, and Cincinnati Public Schools had created an individual website for every South Avondale student, a dashboard of information that detailed kids' attendance, test scores, homework, and classroom participation that was accessible to parents and educators so they could track who was improving and who was falling behind. The school's faculty received a steady stream of memos and spreadsheets showing how each pupil had fared over the past week, month, and year. South Avondale, in fact, was at the forefront of educational big data. K-12 schools should have a clear strategy for developing a data-driven culture, read a U.S. Department of Education report that helped guide Cincinnati's efforts. By studying each student's statistics closely enough, educators believed they could deliver the specific kind of assistance each kid needed most. "Any idea or new program, we signed up for," said Elizabeth Holtzapple, Director of Research and Evaluation at Cincinnati Public Schools. "We had seen how data and analytics had turned around other districts, and we were on board." The turnaround at South Avondale, however, was nowhere to be found. 6 years after the online dashboards were introduced, more than 90% of South Avondale's teachers admitted they hardly ever looked at them, or used the data sent by the district, or read the memos they received each week. In 2008, 63% of South Avondale's third graders failed to meet the state's basic educational benchmarks. So, that year, Cincinnati decided to try something different. The district's top officials targeted South Avondale and 15 other low-performing campuses in what became known as the Elementary Initiative, or EI. The effort was perhaps most notable for what it lacked. The schools were given no additional funds or supplementary teachers. There were no new tutoring sessions or after-school programs. The staff and student body at each campus remained basically the same. Instead, the EI focused on changing how teachers made decisions in their classrooms. The reforms were built around the idea that data can be transformative, but only if people know how to use it. To change students' lives, educators had to understand how to transform all the spreadsheets and statistics and online dashboards into insights and plans. They had to be forced to interact with data until it influenced how they behaved. By the time Dante entered the third grade, 2 years after the EI started, the program was already so successful it was hailed by the White House as a model of inner-city reform. South Avondale's test scores went up so much that the school earned an excellent rating from state officials. By the end of Dante's third grade year, 80% of his classmates were reading at grade level. 84% passed the state math exam. The school had quadrupled the number of students meeting the state's guidelines. South Avondale drastically improved student academic performance in the 2010-11 academic year and changed the culture of the school, a review by the school district read. The school's transformation was so startling that researchers from around the nation soon began traveling to Cincinnati to figure out what the elementary initiative was doing right. When those researchers visited South Avondale, teachers told them that the most important ingredient in the school's turnaround was data. The same data, in fact, that the district had been collecting for years. Teachers said that a data-driven culture had actually transformed how they made classroom decisions. When pressed, however, those teachers also said they rarely looked at the online dashboards or memos or spreadsheets the central office sent around. In fact, the EI was succeeding because teachers had been ordered to set aside those slick data tools and fancy software, and were told instead to start manipulating information by hand. Each school, under orders from the central office, had established a data room, in some cases an empty conference room, in others a large closet that had previously contained cleaning supplies, where teachers had to transcribe test scores onto index cards. They were told to draw graphs on butcher paper that was taped to walls. They ran impromptu experiments. Do test scores improve if kids are placed in smaller reading groups? What happens when teachers trade off classes? And then scribbled the results onto whiteboards. Rather than simply receiving information, teachers were forced to engage with it. The EI had worked because instead of passively absorbing data, teachers made it disfluent, harder to process at first, but stickier once it was really understood. By scribbling out statistics and testing preconceptions, teachers had figured out how to use all the information they were receiving. The elementary initiative, paradoxically, had made data more cumbersome to absorb, but more useful. And from those index cards and hand-drawn graphs, better classrooms emerged. "Something special happened inside those data rooms," said Macon, the principal. "South Avondale improved not because teachers had more information, but because they learned how to understand it. With Google and the Internet and all the information we have now, you can find answers to almost anything in seconds," said Macon. "But South Avondale shows there's a difference between finding an answer and understanding what it means." 2. In the past 2 decades, the amount of information embedded in our daily lives has skyrocketed. There are smartphones that count our steps, websites that track our spending, digital maps to plot our commutes, software that watches our web browsing, and apps to manage our schedules. We can precisely measure how many calories we eat each day, how much our cholesterol scores have improved each month, how many dollars we spend at restaurants, and how many minutes were allocated to the gym. This information can be incredibly powerful. If harnessed correctly, data can make our days more productive, our diets healthier, our schools more effective, and our lives less stressful. Unfortunately, however, our ability to learn from information hasn't necessarily kept pace with its proliferation. Though we can track our spending and cholesterol, we still often eat and spend in ways we know we should avoid. Even simple uses of information, such as choosing a restaurant or a new credit card, haven't necessarily become more simple. To find a good Chinese restaurant, is it better to consult Google, ask your Facebook feed, call up a friend, or search your browser history to see where you ordered from last time? To figure out which credit card to sign up for, should you consult an online guide, call your bank, open those envelopes piling up on the dining room table? In theory, the ongoing explosion in information should make the right answers more obvious. In practice, though, being surrounded by data often makes it harder to decide. This inability to take advantage of data as it becomes more plentiful is called information blindness. Just as snow blindness refers to people losing the capacity to distinguish trees from hills under a blanket of powder, so information blindness refers to our mind's tendency to stop absorbing data when there's too much to take in. One study of information blindness was published in 2004 when a group of researchers at Columbia University tried to figure out why some people sign up for 401k retirement plans while others don't. They studied almost 800,000 people across hundreds of companies who were offered opportunities to enroll in 401k plans. For many workers, signing up for the retirement plans should have been an easy choice. The 401ks offered large tax savings, and many of the companies in the study promised to match employees' contributions, in effect giving them free money. And at firms where workers were offered information on two 401k options, 75% enrolled. Employees at those companies told researchers that signing up seemed obvious. They looked at the two brochures, picked the plan that seemed most sensible, and then watched their retirement accounts grow fatter over time. At other companies, even as the number of plans to choose among increased, sign-ups remained high. When workers were offered 25 different kinds of plans, 72% of them enrolled. But when employees received information on more than 30 plans, something seemed to change. The amount of information people were receiving became so overwhelming that workers stopped making good choices, or, in some cases, any choice at all. At 39 plans, only 65% of people signed up for 401k accounts. At 60 plans, participation dropped to 53%. Every 10 funds added was associated with 1.5% to 2% drop in participation, the researchers wrote in their 2004 study. Signing up for a 401k was still the right decision, but when information became too plentiful, people put the brochures in a drawer and never looked at them again. We've found this in dozens of settings, said Martin Eppler, a professor at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland who studies information overload. The quality of people's decisions generally gets better as they receive more relevant information. But then their brain reaches a breaking point when the data becomes too much. They start ignoring options or making bad choices or stop interacting with the information completely. Information blindness occurs because of the way our brain's capacity for learning has evolved. Humans are exceptionally good at absorbing information, as long as we can break data into a series of smaller and smaller pieces. This process is known as winnowing or scaffolding. Mental scaffolds are like file cabinets filled with folders that help us store and access information when the need arises. If someone is handed a huge wine list at a restaurant, for instance, they'll typically have no problem making a selection, because their brain will automatically place what they know about wine into a scaffold of categories they can use to make binary decisions. Do I want a white or a red? White. And then finer subcategories, expensive or cheap? Cheap. Until they confront a final comparison, the $6 Chardonnay or the $7 Sauvignon Blanc, that draws upon what they have already learned about themselves. I like Chardonnay. We do this so quickly that, most of the time, we're hardly aware it's occurring. Our brains crave reducing things to two or three options, said Eric Johnson, a cognitive psychologist at Columbia University who studies decision-making. So when we're faced with a lot of information, we start automatically arranging it into mental folders and subfolders and sub-subfolders. This ability to digest large amounts of information by breaking it into smaller pieces is how our brains turn information into knowledge. We learn which facts or lessons to apply in a given situation by learning which folders to consult. Experts are distinguished from novices, in part, by how many folders they carry in their heads. An enophile will look at a wine list and immediately rely on a vast system of folders, such as vintage and region, that don't occur to novices. The ENA file has learned how to